I'm done with my trash talking. Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense. Kai is out today, so Matt Levin is here with me. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Kimberly. Good to be here. Thanks, y'all, for joining us this Wednesday, March 20th.
Yes, today we are going to do some news and some smiles, get you in and out of here with the best conversation you'll have heard on a Wednesday. So what you got, Matt?
That is a high promise to our listeners, Kimberly.
I believe in you, Matt. I believe in you.
It's a lot of pressure. Okay, you know I like to start off my news fixes with an annoyingly personal question. You ready for this, Kimberly?
Go for it.
All right, scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you, Kimberly?
Today or in general?
Today, or let's put today aside because you got roped into some unexpected work today. So in general.
I am an extraordinarily fortunate person. I have my health. I have great friends and family, a good job. I'm going to give myself a solid 8. I'm a very fortunate individual. How about you?
Well, Kimberly, oh man, that's far too personal a question. I think I'm right there with you. You know, it depends on, I'll tell you what, if I have an edible, I'm a 10 out of 10. But even, okay. even with that one, I'm with you an 8 out of 10. My news fix, the relevance here. I think we are slightly above average in terms of the overall happiness of Americans. Gallup put out their global world happiness rankings. This was yesterday, I believe. And for the first time, the U.S. slipped out of the top 20 countries in terms of personal happiness. We are 23rd now. Not so great. The marketplacey part of this, which now my brain only thinks in those terms, is this, you know, it's survey data. They ask people basically a version of the question I asked you, you know, scale of 0 to 10. How happy are you with your life? And the data was from, it's a 3-year average of 2021 to 2023. And we are behind the following countries: the United Kingdom, Canada, and Costa Rica, as well as at the top is always those Scandinavian countries that are at the top of like every quality of life index ever made. And what stood out to me is our economy over that period, much better than each of those three countries by most measures, right? Our inflation is less bad than what the UK had. Our economic growth was better than those countries, and unemployment, for the most part, was better here as well. And yet, we do not seem to be as happy as people in those countries. And I know, aren't you working on a series that touches on this?
I am. I'm looking into sort of how people's economic beliefs line up with economic realities, with the, you know, big caveat that everybody has a different economic reality. But yeah, I'm working on some stories on that as well, because it influences a lot of voting behavior, which is why it's particularly relevant in this election. But I mean, I do think there might be a reason that you and I are kind of outliers in the happiness index, because this is a conversation I have with my best friend quite a bit, because I've been a journalist since I was 16 years old, which means I am actively on a daily basis seeking out information, much of which is terrible, right? And I have had to, over the course of my career, actively consume large volumes of really horrible information.
Oh, I like
no
where
real
you're going
option,
with this.
Yeah, with no real option to turn it off. Most people, when the news is depressing, you turn it off and you do something else, or you walk away and you do something else. When it's your job, you have to find a way to compartmentalize that stuff and figure out a way to live your life and not be like crushed by depression on a regular basis, or you self-medicate, which most of the people in our industry do. But
Thus the edible comment from earlier in the show. But go ahead.
There we go. Hey, we have cocktails every Friday. But in all seriousness, I think as journalists, you have to kind of develop a coping mechanism to all the bad news and figure out a way to live your life and take what happiness you can. I think what's happening for everyone else is that the volume of bad news and how much it's thrown at you because of social media and all of the different screens we're staring at all the time has become overwhelming for people who have not built up a resiliency to it. And so I do think that we are kind of in this space where everybody is overwhelmed by all the climate change, the wars, the, you know, economy and what you choose to believe about it, you know, and what you're feeling. Because even if the macroeconomic numbers are good, some of the indicators that we kind of feel deeply in our bones still don't feel very good. Like, can you afford a house? Could you ever retire? You know, and so I think that that factors into it. I mean, and this is what the data was showing. It's the younger folks who are skewing this data who really don't feel like there's hope for the future. And I'm just going to say, you know, you can change the future. Well, some of it, climate change, some of the effects of climate change is a little bit too late, but we can mitigate things. Let me just stop before I make it worse.
No, I think there's definitely something to that. And you mentioned young people driving this. So what was really interesting is that young people in the U.S. ranked 62nd out of all countries where they did this survey. And the other super interesting thing about this is when they looked at this data from 2006 to 2008, back when I would qualify as a younger person under 30, people were happier. They were. And I think I'm of two minds about this. One is like it's hard to look at that and not say smartphones and exposure to all this information as you were just laying out. The other part, though, is that it does seem to be kind of a uniquely American and I guess North American, based on how they do this data, experience where other parts of the world, young people, we haven't seen a dramatic drop in happiness levels, you know, between over the last decade or so, which it's, you know, they have smartphones and social media in East Asia. They have smartphones and social media in sub-Saharan Africa, right? It's all over the world.
Not to the same penetration that we have it here.
East Asia, though. I mean,
which countries are you talking about in East Asia? So if you're talking about a country like Japan, yes, or South Korea, yes.
But
I mean, I think that they have better social safety nets there than we do.
Yes, I think that's a big part of this, too.
Yes.
All right, that's it for my news fix. What do you got, Kimberly?
Mine is something that Marissa and Courtney were flagging for me earlier, and there's so much interesting research about, you know, sort of changing opinions and new research when it comes to women and women's health. Like, it's been all over social media that they are, like, just now starting to test period products with actual blood instead of other fluids, which apparently forever research has been terrible in that regard, and that's why tampons and maxi pads have been terrible for decades, because they weren't actually using blood to test them. But all of this builds up to the fact that on Monday, President Biden signed an executive order with this comprehensive set of actions to improve and expand research on women's health. I'm going to read here from the 19th News. They announced more than 20 new actions and commitments by a wide range of federal agencies for research on issues that emerge across a woman's lifespan, from maternal health outcomes and mental health challenges to autoimmune diseases and menopause. Scrolling down, the announcement contains four major components: prioritizing women's health research and research innovation, strengthening research and data standards related to women's health, galvanizing new research on women's midlife health with the focus on conditions that occur after menopause, like heart attacks, Alzheimer's disease, and osteoporosis, and an assessment from the Office of Management and Budget to better understand the unmet funding needs when it comes to women's health research. And I think that we're already starting to see changing conversations around menopause, for example, and a lot more emphasis and investment on treatments for some of the symptoms associated with menopause. Like, I just saw the story in Reuters about Bayer/Bayer, whatever you want to call it, that it's requesting, the pharmaceutical company is requesting regulatory approval for a menopause drug, quote, after the daily pill was shown to ease hot flashes in a late stage trial, providing some relief for the pharmaceuticals unit. But this is something that has been, you know, kind of a famously unavoidable symptom of menopause, that women really suffer with these hot flashes and other symptoms. And so, in this article, it says, in the race for non-hormonal menopausal symptoms relief drugs, Bayer is behind Japan's Astellas, which last year won U.S. and European approval for a similar treatment. And there is an Acer Therapeutics had one, but it's not doing so well in the trials. There was an injection that I saw a university in Florida is working on something. And there's also new research coming out of Europe showing that there may actually be some evidence that menopause has been getting worse over the generations for women. It's not clear yet.
Yeah, this was super interesting.
Right. So that previous generations of women reported fewer hot flashes than newer generations of women entering menopause. Now, why that is it environmental conditions? Is it what we're eating? Is it all the hormones in our food? It could also be because we are more willing to talk about it and treat it seriously, that women are reporting it more. Who knows? So there's a lot of interesting research here. There's a lot of money going into this industry now, because as women age with a bit more agency and a lot more money than previous generations of women, they're like, we're not going to take it. We want treatment. So I think it's all very interesting.
Do you, with your knowledge of how DC works, let's say Trump is the next president, is this one of the executive orders you think he rolls back?
Let me think about that for a second. No.
So just
like, no, I think it'll be just like, it would be a lower priority thing. There's doesn't seem to be much in there on abortion. and that would be the thing that would flag it for a rollback. But I need to read a little bit more into the executive order. But I doubt it. At least it wouldn't be top priority.
I would tend to agree with that, too.
Yeah.
All right. Time for happier topics.
So, ready to move on to smiles. Yes. Yours is health-related. Why don't you go first, since we were just talking about health things?
Yeah, a little natural segue there. There is a new skin biopsy test for Parkinson's disease. So with Parkinson's, conventionally, you could pretty much only diagnose it with the presentation of symptoms. And I actually, you know, I've had relatives who've, you know, obviously the classic symptom is that, you know, shaking. And I've had relatives who have gone to neurologists, and, you know, they basically ask them a series of questions and, like, ask them to take a walk and watch how they walk. But there wasn't any, like, specific medical diagnostic that they did to determine whether they had Parkinson's or not, which kind of – I didn't know this until I had a couple relatives actually experience this. But that may be changing. There is a skin biopsy that you can take – around the ankle, knee, and shoulder that would detect a protein that's associated with Parkinson's disease. This is a good thing. It's a good thing. You might be able to detect Parkinson's earlier, which, you know, there's no cure for Parkinson's yet, but the earlier you catch it, the better the therapeutics actually work. So there's a story about this in the Wall Street Journal, which we'll link to in the show notes.
That's great news. Love medical advancements that can help people live better. You know, as much as terrifying as a lot of this AI stuff is, I'm really excited at all of the medical advancements that seem to be coming down the pipeline with this additional computing power. And that is exciting to me. So, also exciting to me is that in my patio garden, my little sprouts are starting to come up, and I overdid it last year when it came to my garden. I planted way too many things and I could not maintain them all, and it got too hot and it was too much. I enjoy gardening. I like my fruits and vegetables and herbs and all my plants. So this year, instead of planting like 68 different varieties of things in my little container garden, I only planted like 40-something. So I scaled it back a bit. But my sprouts are starting to come up, and my bok choy is coming up. I've got a couple little carrot sprouts. I've got my Swiss chard lasted from last year. Like, it hung on, and so it's coming back. My peas are coming up. This all makes me happy. It makes me smile. Good luck to all the gardeners out there. I believe in you. We can do it. But this made me notice this article in the AP today about garden centers trying to convince all these people who started gardening during the pandemic to keep gardening. And, you know, all these people became like plant parents and spending all this money on indoor and outdoor plants during the lockdown for the people who were able to stay at home. And so now that people can do other things, these garden centers are very concerned. So I'm reading here. It says the spring season is crucial because garden centers can make about 60% of sales during the 12 weeks of spring. That's particularly true for centers in the north since there are fewer months to plant. And so to regain sales momentum, garden centers must navigate a number of challenges as another spring season kicks in. Chief among them are volatile weather and higher costs for labor and plant materials, which in turn has forced the companies to raise the prices for consumers. One positive development, younger households, particularly the 18 to 34 year old age group and the 35 to 44 year old age group, have seen larger increases in spending than older households. Therefore, basically that means we're going to be continuing to buy more plants because plants make people happy.
And maybe a cure there for the happiness malaise that we were talking about earlier for younger folks. You just need more plants.
You just need more
life.
Plants. Exactly.
Yeah.
Peak millennial. Buy another plant.
when you All end... Right. I have one quick question for you, Kimberly.
Yeah.
When you and Sabri, probably the most famous green thumb amongst the Marketplace reporters, yourself notwithstanding, when you get together, do you guys just talk plants like 90% of the time?
We talk quite a bit about plants, but Sabri does like indoor, tropical, very like, you have to be super careful and give them special water and special light and special humidity plants.
Sounds like a lot of work.
I do plant. Yeah. My plant strategy is like, if you survive, you can continue to grow and maybe be planted again in the future. If not, tough luck. It's,
yeah,
it's survival
so be it.
Of the fittest in and out of indoors and outdoors. Like, there's a reason I don't grow spinach. Why? Because spinach never is happy with me. I grow Chiji Masai instead because it's a plant that seems to like my patio. Done. I've tried to grow ferns in my house multiple times, like, and they just always die. Fine. Screw the ferns. I have Diffenbachia, dumb canes. They're very happy. I'm happy with them. We get along great. The end. It's not that deep. I'm not spending a lot of money on plants, although apparently I'm like one of the de facto plant people in my building, so people will just like leave abandoned plants outside my door.
Oh, wow.
I'll come home and there's like a spider plant just hanging out, and I'm like, oh, okay, here we go. We'll see if it lives.
Wow, it's a powerful position.
I guess. Anyway, I would love to hear from everybody about your plantscapes and how your gardens are going, if you have one, indoors or out, and also what people's plant strategies are. Are you a Sabri gardener or a survival of the fittest Kimberly gardener? You can let us know your thoughts on that, because that is it for us today. Kai and I are going to be back tomorrow. So until then, you can send your thoughts, questions, comments, also any audio you think we should talk about to makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART. Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, and Talia Menchaca is our intern.
Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Marissa Cabrera. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital.
Look at you getting the timing down.
Oh, thank you. It was totally by accident.